This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3457 for Tuesday, the 2nd of November 2021. Today's show is entitled Tables and is part of the series Databases. It is hosted by Klaatu and is about 38 minutes long and carries a clean flag. The summary is how and why I convert tables to lists.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Everybody, I got a message on Mastodon from a person named F Toys, and they said that they were listening to a show about from me about macros and how they used to use macros to generate tables in HTML. And it got me to thinking about how much I hate tables, but also I can see the appreciation for tables. It's a complex relationship, and I want to talk about that here on Hacker Public Radio. So, tables, what are they? Well, a spreadsheet would be the quintessential example of a table, I think, right? You've got your columns across the top, you got your rows down the side. The intersection of those, as you can scroll across the page, are called cells. That's where a row and a column intersect, as it were. It's called a cell, and in that cell, there's information. Now, we see this model of content delivery in lots of different places. We see it in books, and they're quite useful, actually. I have a book here in front of me that has a lot of tables in it. I'm just on page 41, and I'm already on table number 31. That's how many tables there are in this particular book. It's a Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition Player Handbook. So lots of tables. And tables can be really good for clarity, for quick reference. And tables also have a kind of implicit communication that they carry with them. And, you know, you see a table and you understand what you're looking at. You know that you are about to see something, usually some kind of almost a comparison, maybe it's not exactly a comparison, but in a way it's a comparison almost no matter what, because there are different cells, and the further you go along in the table, the information gets modified by what column and row it happens to fall in. So for instance, if I look at a table, actually right here, here's a table. So a priest Thaco for level 3 is 20, but the priest's Thaco at level 6 is 18, and then at 7 it's 16, and then at 16 it's 10, and so on. But if you look at the same data for a rogue, at level 3 they're 19, at level 6 they're 18, at level 10 they're 16, and at level 16 they're 13. So you get the sense that you're looking at information that changes either over time or under certain conditions. And so it's a great way to kind of reference, like if you're doing something and you have a table, you don't need to know what a priest or a rogue or a warrior or a wizard is. You don't need to know what Thaco is. But if you're looking to optimize those things, you think, okay, well, I want the best Thaco I can possibly get. So you can look at this table. It's laid out in this manner, and you can tell how you could optimize that by just looking across. So by 20, the lowest Thaco there is under the warrior class. And so I guess if I'm aiming to optimize my Thaco across time, I should be playing a warrior. And that turns out to be true. Their Thaco goes down by 1 every single level, while everyone else has a different rate of advancement. So whether you know what that is or not, you know now the relationship between, for instance, a warrior and a priest. You can look at the table and say, okay, the warrior, you decrements 1 per per heading, per column, whereas the priest does, it decrements 2 every 3 columns. So now we know. Don't know what we know, but we know. And that's a great thing about tables, is that they present the information in an easy to reference kind of manner. And something that may or may not be even closer to home here for you, it depends on what world you're coming from as a listener, but let's say that you're looking for a Linux distribution and you have a very specific package management requirement. You know you like DNF, you just can't decide which distro you want to go with. And so you might look at a table that gives you the operating system, let's say the init system, and the package manager, and, you know, I don't know, something else, the default shell. And you could scroll through this list and kind of scan the table, and you kind of focus in on the column that says package manager, and because that's the thing that you care about. And so you see the list. Okay, DNF, well, there it is. So we've got, what do we got? Oh, we got Fedora. Well, that's kind of expected. We got RHEL and CentOS and Mageia. I hadn't thought of Mageia. And maybe Open Mandriva, although actually I don't know if they're actually using DNF yet. I know Mageia did switch over to DNF, and so on. And then you could maybe, you'd keep scrolling down the list, and then you'd run into Slack PKG. Well, that's not DNF. Which one is that? Oh, that's Slackware. Emerge, that's Gentoo, okay. And then apt, and that list would go on for half of a page or several pages, and so on. So you can use a table as a way to focus in on a specific kind of information and then cross-reference what kind of data surrounds the thing that you care about. It is sort of, it is a visual sort of way to select a table in a database. So that's a table. Tables are really good. They're great. They're great for reference. They're quick. They're fast. They communicate the differences of data to the reader quickly. They're easy to reference. They're easy to cross-reference. So why do I hate tables? Well, obviously, I don't hate tables. I mean, I actually really, really like a good table. I think tables are great, going on record saying that tables are great. However, tables are also a real pain to lay out. And, I mean, initially, they're not. I mean, you have a table. You generate the table in whatever formatting tool you're using, whether it's a word processor or code like HTML or XML, and it's done, and you're happy with it. The problems usually come around in two different places. One is maintenance, and the other is, probably not in this order actually, one is maintenance, and the other is physical layout. So tables, I'll just start with the layout, because this is the obvious one, and the reason I really, really hate it. The layout is just based on literally what media your reader is viewing the table within. So if you're writing your initial table for, I don't know, the internet, then you probably have essentially the entire screen of your user. And there's no way of telling what that user's screen is, but we all kind of assume a reasonably modern display. And I'm thinking personally of a desktop because I'm sitting in front of my desktop. Maybe you're thinking about a laptop. Either way, they're all about, you know, 1920 by 1080, or maybe they're a lot larger now. Whatever it is, it's kind of like, you know, a big display that you can look at a document, whatever a document is, on full screen, and you get the whole thing. Well, that in itself poses one problem, and we've probably all seen this, where you're on a page that has set its table to just take up as much width as it possibly can, and you think, great, well, now I'm never going to have a problem cross-referencing this table because it's big, taking up the entire width of this of my document. But have you ever tried to look at like a 3-column table that has forced itself to spread out into a, you know, a physical, like a 30-inch thing? You know, every column is like literally physically 10 inches wide. It gets kind of stupid, and it gets a little bit difficult to track the data across the page then, at least it is for me, because you look at the left and you say, okay, that's that one. That's Mageia. Now I'm going to trace across. I've gotten onto the wrong row now. Okay, let me go back. And trace with my finger so that I'm not losing, you know, and so you have to like map it out almost. It's too far apart. The opposite is obviously true. I mean, if you've ever seen a table rendered in HTML on a a mobile phone, then you've probably seen tables that just physically, literally cannot fit on that mobile screen. Like at some point, a 10-column table with reasonably large words, it just literally can't fit on the, maybe the 3-inch wide mobile screen. Oh, sure, you can rotate it and give yourself a good 6 to 7 inches, but it's kind of difficult to fit all of that information on such a small screen. And maybe you have to just zoom out so you can kind of like make it all fit, or maybe you have to zoom in and then just keep scrolling around, and so you're kind of like looking through this weird sort of view portal at this larger table. It's really clunky, and that's, you know, if you're trying to optimize that from the user perspective, it's clunky in lots of different examples that I've just gone over. From the developer perspective, it's clunky because you want to optimize it for each display. I mean, ideally, you want the information to be useful. That's why you're writing it down in the first place. And so you try to make adaptations. You try to think, you know, maybe there's a library out there to reflow a table correctly, or maybe there's a certain trick that you can do as the developer based on attempting to detect the screen size and so on. So one does try to optimize it, but it starts to become really difficult to maintain, because now you're having to like recode every single table depending on certain conditions, and frankly, those conditions you don't even always really know what those are. Maintenance gets really tough as well later on, or earlier on when you're actually writing the thing. I don't know if you've ever tried to write a table in XML or HTML. There are a lot of tags that you have to come up with, that you have to use, remember? And all of those, and the way that it's getting laid out, of course, in your code has basically no bearing on what it's going to look like later. Which, I mean, that's what code's all about, right? I mean, like, it very rarely, the code doesn't usually look like the render. Like, that's why we call it code. That's not the only reason we call it code. But, I mean, that's an expectation. But for tables, I mean, it really can be difficult to sort of remember where you are in your code. To the extent that sometimes I've fallen back on, like, if I'm composing a table from scratch in HTML, I've sometimes gone and rendered the table in Markdown and then converted the Markdown to HTML, because at least with Markdown you get this weird kind of, you know, ASCII rendering of a table. You use dashes and pipe symbols to construct a table, which you'd think kind of would make some sense. I mean, it does kind of make sense, but on the other hand, it's actually really clunky too, because I don't know if you've ever tried to edit a table that is composed of just dashes and pipes, but you spend more time making all of the cells kind of like line up correctly. Org mode helps with this. It has some really nice table tools that kind of help with that, but it can be really, really clunky, and sometimes you just think, why am I doing it this way? Why don't I just open up a spreadsheet and put the information in there and then, I don't know, convert that to HTML somehow or something like that? So it's not fun is the point. And those are the reasons I really don't like tables. And I really, really like the idea of being able to construct information and then deliver it in lots of different ways. So if I've written something down, I want to know, I find great comfort in knowing that I can then export that document. The source code of that document can be converted and exported or whatever into multiple formats, meaning I should be able to deliver the thing that I am trying to communicate. I should be able to deliver that as a plain text document, you know, Markdown, whatever. As the source code itself, XML or whatever, I should be able to export it as HTML. I should be able to export it as EPUB, PDF, some kind of word processing document, and whatever else comes around. You know, like whatever other format there might be. I want to know that there's one source of there's one source code, and from that one source code, I can render out to a lot of different formats. Because presumably, my readers are going to want a lot of different formats. And presumably, there are formats out there in the future that I have not anticipated yet that I would like to have some kind of future-proof against or getting into, I want to be able to just sort of inherit those future formats. And I don't know what those will be, but ideally I'll be prepared for them. And I'm not going to have 31 or 81 or 120 tables that I then have to go through and manually modify because I didn't expect there to be some other format for delivery, for content delivery. So I've established why tables are great. I've told you why I think tables are horrible to deal with as an author / developer / content creator. And now I'm going to talk about what I do about tables in real life. Like, this isn't a dogmatic type of thing. This isn't something that always happens no matter what with me. It is something that usually happens, though. It is something that is very common for me to do, and that is to convert tables into some other format of data. And this is data conversion. Like, this is the kind of thing that you might do, with a programming language. You're parsing some kind of data, you're parsing it and converting it to some other schema. This isn't a mindless thing that you can't that you can count on making sense all the time. You sometimes have to really restructure the data. But that in itself, I think, is an interesting challenge. So let's take something that probably many of us will be at least vaguely familiar with. And I'm going to try to do it sort of really simple, really easy. We'll take it slow and we'll convert a couple of different tables to lists. Okay, so let's say you've got a table. The top, and I'm keeping it really simple here, the top row is OS, init system, and package manager. Those are our columns. So three columns: OS, init system, package manager. Down the side, under OS, we'll have Fedora, Slackware, and Gentoo. Rows, columns, simple. So under Fedora, as the init system, we'll have systemd, and the package manager is DNF. Slackware, we've got BSD for the init system, or BSD style for the init system, Slack PKG for the package manager. And then Gentoo, we've got OpenRC for the init system, and package manager emerge. I mean, let's not get into questions of whether or not Gentoo would necessarily insist on OpenRC being the init system, because it's quite a flexible system. You could build it with something else. Same goes, frankly, for Slackware. But I'm just going, we'll just leave it with that, just so we have different data through our table. Now, as a table, that's a three-column table, four rows. Well, maybe you could say three rows with a header row, but I mean, that's four rows. It's quite likely that actually probably wouldn't be a super problematic table, but it'll be the example. So instead of structuring it as a table, which again, admittedly, you know, especially if we imagine under that Fedora wouldn't be the only entry for instance, systemd and DNF combination. Like, there'd certainly be RHEL, there'd certainly be CentOS, there'd certainly be Magia. Haven't looked at OpenMandriva in preparation for this episode, so I don't remember what they're up to right now. But, you know, you'd have more there. Slackware would be on a line of its own. Although maybe not, maybe there'd be some systems under Slackware that would also be using a BSD or BSD style init system. So maybe there would be some listed there. OpenRC, maybe there'd be some other things that we could list there, like Arch or something. I don't know. So, you know, you can imagine this list being bigger in really all of the different directions. But here we go. So instead of writing that as a table, I would choose to write that as a bulleted list, or possibly as a itemized list, or I should say, what is it called in DocBook? Variable list. And so you might have the heading, or the first bullet, as Fedora, and then under that you'd have two bullets. You'd have sub bullets. You'd have init system : systemd, package manager : DNF, and then Slackware, init system, BSD, package manager, Gentoo, init system, OpenRC, package manager, emerge, and so on. So you would essentially get yourself into kind of a loop over the initial column, the OS column, and that would become your top level bullet points. And then you would subjugate the other cells in the table to sub bullet points under under that column, and that would be the loop, because you'd always have that predictable init system, package manager, heading init system package manager, heading init system package manager. So that works. It tells the same story data-wise. It delivers the exact same information, and it does so in such a way that is predictable and repeatable, which doesn't really make any difference except that it helps the user get that same kind of cross-reference advantage. So if I know that I'm looking at this list and all I care about is the package management system, then I know after like the first one or two that package manager is always going to be the second sub-bullet point under each heading. And I even label that every single time to really, really drive home. I mean, that's redundant. And you could argue that we should just, like, for sort of conservation of bits, I guess, that we should just say Fedora bullet point systemd bullet point DNF, Slackware bullet point BSD style bullet point Slack package, Gentoo bullet point open, you know. But, I mean, why do that? Like, why not? It doesn't cost that much extra to put a little heading in front of each one. So you've got the key and value pair. It's almost YAMLian. It's almost like YAML, really. I mean, if we're looking at this, it's essentially saying here's a sequence containing mappings, and that's what we're delivering. And it's relatively simple to scan through that, you know, as a human with it, sort of human brain, human eyes. It's relatively simple to scan through that and extract the focus that you want. Is it as easy as looking at a table? I actually find that it is. Does it have the same communication, that sort of that upfront 1-2 punch that a table has? I don't feel like it necessarily does. I think we humans really do find tables comforting and familiar, or at least I should say as a certain kind of human. I don't know that all humans find tables comforting and familiar, although I think that we do, because you see tables even in when you're shopping online. You'll look at comparisons, like, does this GPU have such and such, or what about this subscription plan? What kind of benefits do you get with if you take this level of subscription versus that level of subscription, and so on? So you do kind of get those, you get that in a lot of different areas, I feel. So I think it might just be, yeah, sort of an inborn natural trait that you see a table and you understand what it's trying to communicate. Whereas a bullet list, you don't necessarily always know, is this just a list of stuff, or is this a comparison of stuff? Like, you do have to work a little bit harder to understand, or rather to establish what, for instance, a list is really trying to communicate to you. Like, what is the data structure? But through repetition and verbosity, I feel like that structure can be conveyed pretty quickly. And the benefit for me far outweighs losing that sort of upfront, hey, here's a table, now you know what you're going to be looking for. I would rather have the bullet list because they're easier to code, they're easier to maintain, they're easier to export. Now, of course, a table doesn't always translate exactly to a list the way this one did. This was a really good example of a sequence of data that contain key and value pairs. That's pretty easy to convert into a list, to be honest. I mean, it's a really direct kind of translation. Sometimes that doesn't always work. So for instance, let's say that we're looking at a table that is comparing the licenses and interplanetary existences of operating systems. So you might have as your columns your operating system, you have a column saying whether or not it's open source, and you have a column defining whether or not it has landed on Mars. So this would be a classic table that you'd see when you're looking at, I don't know, like a car sales report, or a, like I said earlier, like graphics card comparison or something like that, where you'd have like little green check marks in one column, and at certain points they would stop being green check marks and they'd turn into red X's. But if you go over to the next column where you pay $5,000 more for that car or for that graphics processor, then suddenly you get more green check marks and fewer red X's. And then finally, if you go premium and pay $10,000 more, you get all green check marks, nothing but green check marks all the way down. So anyway, you got operating system, open source, landed on Mars. Those are your columns. Your rows are Linux, BSD, and Mac OS. Linux, open source, yes. BSD, open source, yes. macOS, open source, no. Landed on Mars, Linux, yes. BSD, no. macOS, no. Don't hold me to this data. I don't actually know what has or has not landed on Mars. Some BSD code probably has almost certainly on Mars, but the kernel itself, as far as I know, is not on Mars. As of this recording, as of my very brief research. So as a bullet list, if we took my previous example very literally, we would have some ugly list like bullet point Linux, open source colon yes, landed on Mars yes, bullet point BSD, sub bullet point, open source yes, landed on Mars no, macOS, open source no, landed on Mars colon no. That would be serviceable, but I feel like in that case, the Boolean values of yes and no make the verbosity, I don't know, a little bit, it becomes like with that kind of verbosity, then the landed on Mars colon no, well then why even mention it? It hasn't landed on Mars, so why occupy my visual and brain processing space with something that resolves to it doesn't matter, like it doesn't to a no value. That doesn't add anything, I think, in this case. I think it actually requires more brain processing and more it provides more visual noise than what we could do. So in that case, I don't think that the presentation, the translation of the table into a bullet point really services the reader. I think what would be better, what I really think would be better is to just not present this as a table. So for instance, I would just write Linux and BSD are open source operating systems while macOS is not. Of these POSIX compliant systems, only Linux has landed on Mars so far. There, I've just delivered the same amount of information in two sentences and in a clearer and more fluid fashion. Now, to be fair, that might not always be the intent. Like, you might not want to be writing prose. You may actually want to provide people with sort of the data. I mean, certainly you always have the choice of just taking that data and doing a literal translation where you make the first row, the first cells, the first column of cells, the main bullet points, and then sub bullet points of key and value pairs. That totally works. But I'm trying to get an example where maybe that isn't optimal, like maybe that's not what you're trying to do. So it's just maybe the thing that you defaulted to. Well, I'm doing tables anyway, I might as well put this comparison into a table. But let's assume for a moment that that's not necessary. You don't need the green check marks and red X's. You're just trying to convey the information. So another way to do that could be to summarize what's common and then highlight the differences. So for instance, you might write one line that says, or I guess two lines, there are a few Linux systems on Mars. Neither BSD or macOS have yet landed on Mars. And then as bullet points, bullet point, Linux and BSD are both open source. macOS is based partially on open source and includes components from the BSD, KDE, GNU, and other projects. There. So now you've taken up visual sort of processing cycles with the bullet points, and you've highlighted in as a group the common elements. So in one bullet point, you have defined what certain groups have in common. Linux and BSD are both open source. So that takes care of Linux open source, yes, landed on Mars, yes. BSD open source, yes, and that's it. So that highlights those three cells. We still have three cells that we haven't talked about, which is the fact that BSD is not open, it has not landed on Mars, and that macOS is not open source and has not landed on Mars. So for the second bullet point, then we highlight the fact that macOS is only partially based on open source. So that takes care of the open source colon no under Mac along the macOS axis. And that's it. And then the sentence that we summarized the data, we've got there are Linux systems on Mars. So that's Linux landed on Mars, yes. And neither BSD or macOS have yet landed on Mars. So that's macOS no and BSD no for the landed on Mars. Still other times you just have to question what the table's actual intent or purpose really is. And so to bring it back around to where we started with D&D, for instance, There are lots of tables in D&D books. That's just kind of it got started early on, and it proved useful and kind of endearing, and so they've persisted. And even in the latest edition of D&D, there are tables under each character class that sort of outlines the lifespan of that character. So if you choose, for instance, to play a barbarian, then there's a table telling you how that barbarian is going to progress over the course of their duration, of their life in the game. And that's a useful thing. And I think in one way, you look at that table and you say, well, that's for a player who's looking through this handbook, trying to figure out what class they want to play. And they're going to look at this table and look at things like, well, what kind of bonuses do I get throughout each level? And they'll look at that. They'll look at the barbarian, for instance, and look at the progression of the barbarian. And they'll be happy with that. But then they'll go back and maybe flip over to the fighter and see what progression the fighter has and what kind of benefits they get across, you know, through the course of their lifespan. And I think in a way that's kind of the intent of those tables, is to sort of be a summary and maybe a little bit of a shopping list for players as they try to choose which class they want to play. But if you really think about it, if you really look at that table and think about what's actually being conveyed, there's not really that much, there aren't a whole lot of specifics in that table. You get things like, at a certain level, you get a primal path. Well, what is a primal path? Well, if you've played D&D before 5th edition, then you know what a primal path, or you might know what a primal path is for a barbarian, if you've played a barbarian. But you'll know that primal path is actually a set of other options. So you have to choose your primal path. So knowing that you get a primal path at 3rd level as a barbarian doesn't actually tell you anything. It just tells you at 3rd level you're going to have to make some new choices about sort of how your character develops. And that's not even summarized in this table. It's just an alert that, hey, you're going to have to make choices. Well, there's a certain implicit expectation here that you're going to have to make choices about your character. If you know anything about leveling up, whether you've played D&D or just a video game that has you do some action when you get a certain number of points, some kind of level up action, which is pretty common these days, then you know that at a new level, you're going to have choices to make. That's an RPG. So I don't know how useful the table actually is in terms of sort of a summary of that character. And when I was adapting the free, under the open game license, the free rules of 5th edition for players who hadn't yet purchased the player handbook, I decided to render those tables as lists instead. And frankly, I was pretty happy with them. They are not, you know, by any means, they are not, I think probably, they take up more space than the table. I think there's no question about that. The table has the advantage of being able to use both vertical and horizontal space to its advantage, while bullet lists don't. They just use vertical space. So you get, on one page, you get two columns of a bullet list, whereas what really should be happening is like maybe a fourth of the page or a third of the page gets taken up by one glorious table. But I didn't want to have to deal with the table. I didn't find it fun to code the table. I didn't find it fun to maintain the table. And so I chose, and I also didn't know what format my players would be consuming the data, because I was going to offer it to them as plain text. I was going to offer it to them as EPUB and as PDF. And I could probably offer it to them as HTML if I wanted to. So I didn't know what format they were going to consume this. So I didn't really want, you know, especially in plain text, the table just looks horrific. It's a horrible thing to look at because it runs right off the page. ASCII text or monospace text, I mean, it is as wide as it is, every single character. And so it if you have a lot of data in your table, it just keeps going and going and going forever. So that wasn't something that I wanted to do. And so I translated it into a list, and it worked. And the thing about that is that it was really just a YAML sequence, if you think of it in YAML terms. So there I didn't do necessarily predictable key value pairs, because not everything happens at every level. So for instance, you have level 1 And then, so this was a numbered list, which makes a sense. So one is level one. The bullet point under that is proficiency plus two. So now your proficiency bonus is plus two. Good to know. You get rage and you get unarmored defense. You have to look up what both of those things are later in the text, but that's just kind of how D&D works. At level two, number two, level two, you get reckless attack and danger sense. At level three, you get rage and primal, so more rage and danger sense. Primal path at level three. Four, level four, ability score improvement. Five, proficiency plus three. So now we're kind of getting some repetition here, but not really. I mean, you'll see proficiency upgrades throughout. You'll see a couple of ability score improvements throughout. So things pop back up, but it's not predictable unless you're very, very familiar with kind of like the way that D&D levels up. But what I realized, even as I was translating the table, is that the intent of the table may seem to be a good summary of information about that class, but actually what it is a guide for players to know what to do when they level up. It can be a very sort of frantic, frightening experience to level up. You think, oh my gosh, what do I have to do? I have to make changes to my character. What kind of changes do I have to make? Well, with this list, it tells you correctly exactly what you need to do. And is it better than a table? Frankly, I think it is, to be honest, because a table doesn't necessarily say, here are the changes that you need to make. It more communicates the idea of, hey, here's an overview of what your class is going to be like over the course of level 1 through 20. That doesn't really, I mean, you have to, it's another step, I think, for many players to think, ah, okay, so if this is an overview, it is also a recipe. Whereas a list, especially a numbered list, it just cries out, this is a recipe. This is an algorithm. These are the steps that you have to take. Start at one, apply these items. When you get to two, come back to this list, start at two, and apply these items. This is all cumulative. There's no implication that you have to replace anything. This is very clearly, it's building on itself as you increment levels. So frankly, I think in many ways, a list for that purpose is superior to a table, even though a table is what I think the designers of that text thought was the most logical, sort of obvious method of delivery. And I mean, I'll admit that the table probably is useful. I mean, it is a great, once again, it's a great at-a-glance tool. If you can afford to have a table for that sort of at-a-glance overview, I will admit that's not too bad. Is it all that different from a list? I don't think so. For me, I'm just as happy scanning over a list quickly as I am a table. But I think there is, I acknowledge and I even identify with, like I feel the same sense of sort of comfort and relief. Ah, here's all the information in one relatively small footprint. Here's all the information all at once. Now, I'll never look at that table again, or maybe I will, just to kind of get an idea of where I'm headed. But for the actual sort of step-by-step process, the list is actually really, really useful, and it has become my preferred method of consuming that information, interestingly. I would rather look at my lists than the tables in the D&D book when I'm playing a character. When I'm doing a quick reference as Dungeon Master to figure out for a player that might not be clear on some feature, then I often do flip straight to that table because I'm like, hey, that's going to be all the information right where I need it. Although, frankly, I could also get that information from my list anyway. So I kind of like my list is what I'm trying to say. Anyway, those are my thoughts on tables and how to convert data from tables into something that might be easier to code, to maintain, and certainly render, and possibly even understand for your readers. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.